Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity Books. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this programme is Peter Spierenborg, who's Professor of Historical Criminology at Erasmus University Rotterdam, and in the words of Steven Pinker, one of the world's experts on the history of violent crime. In 2008, Polity published his History of Murder, Personal Violence in Europe from the Middle Ages to the Present, and this autumn they publish a collection of his essays entitled Violence and Punishment, Civilizing the Body Through Time. The book looks not only at broad trends in crime and punishment since the Middle Ages, but also attempts to explain the reduction in incidence of violent crime and in the severity of punishments. Spierenborg, who was taught by Norbert Elias and whose work is influenced by his, also looks at the interrelationship between gender, honour and the body, which he situates within his broad analysis of the civilizing process. The angle of the lens widens still further in the final chapters, which tackle corollary developments to the decline of violence, such as developing notions of etiquette, changes in festive behaviour, and, peering back into prehistory, what it meant for humans when they first began to realise they were mortal. Peter Spierenborg says in the preface to his new book that he became a historical criminologist almost by chance, so I began by asking him to tell me more about that.
Well, I was a history student in Amsterdam in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And by coincidence, that was not only a time of political ferment, but also a time when Norbert Elias came to Amsterdam for guest lectures. And I was very much impressed by his writings and his lectures. He was actually, I consider him my major teacher. I mean, in that time of political ferment, student movement, Vietnam and all that, many people turned to ideologies like Marxism, and Elias, I think, offered a sound scholarly alternative.
And I guess the field of the history of crime and punishment was fairly underdeveloped then, was it?
Yeah, again, because I first became interested in Elias's work, and that actually gets into my book when I talk about manners and etiquette in the Netherlands. That was the first thing that I did. And then actually, when I was looking for a suitable subject for my thesis, it was my supervisor who suggested do it on punishment. I would have liked to do it more broader about violence like I'm doing in my book now, but you know, when you're writing a thesis, your supervisor wants you to take a limited subject and said, okay, look in punishments in Amsterdam, and that's basically what I did. And then I found out that there were some in the Netherlands and other scholars in France and England who were also working on crime and punishment, and that it was a kind of sort of exciting new pioneer field.
And trying to do more with it, obviously, than simply catalogue it or to celebrate a decline in violence, but to actually theorise what was going on and try and look at the forces which were in operation.
Yeah, actually, many people then believed, and many people still believe, that we live in a very violent time. That, of course, when you would include wars the world over, or armed conflicts, or even genocides, which is a subject that I'm sort of venturing into now, but that's another story, then there would be a point. But when you talk about everyday, ordinary violence within the confines of states, violence among citizens, then if you look at it from the Middle Ages onwards, there is a clear downward trend. It's only recently, since the 1970s, that it has gone up a little bit. So we have the trough of violence, as I call it in my previous book, in the 1950s and 1960s. But even today, ordinary violence, homicide, if you compare it to the Middle Ages or even the 17th century, it has much gone down.
It's true, isn't it, that violence and the perception of violence are two different things, that they may not necessarily correlate, may they? The actual incidence of violence in society and how fearful people are of becoming victims of violence.
Well, the fear of violence and the actual incidence of violence actually correlate inversely a little bit, not very strong. But there have been some studies on the Middle Ages that suggests that people weren't afraid of all the homicides and the slayings connected to honor or disputes or quarrels or whatever that there were all around them. They considered that as a fact of life. They were not afraid of violence. They were afraid of other things. But anyway, in the 19th century, when violence had the incidence of violence, ordinary violence had gone down much, then suddenly people, respectable citizens, they became fearful of being robbed or of gang violence. And recently there's even more concern about violence. So we live in compared to earlier times, we live in a relatively non-violent society, at least as regards everyday, what people experience around them. But the fear for violence and the concern about violence has very much heightened.
We often in English use the phrase meaningless violence. Do you think violence is ever meaningless, or is there always some way of talking about it and explaining it and giving it meaning, however repugnant that meaning may be?
Well, I think that you're right, that violence always has a meaning, at least for those participating in it, for the perpetrator. There's always some previous history that you can study that explains it. When people talk about meaningless violence, or in the Netherlands they call it senseless violence, they just mean that it's violence that should not happen. Or they mean something like, well, if this guy who had, they consider a minor quarrel that turns out fatefully, and they say, oh my God, this is senseless violence. And then I often think if the perpetrator had also robbed him, it would not have been senseless violence, because then it would have been understandable or something. But really, the term meaningless violence refers to the appreciation of the act, that people think this should not have happened, which as a person, I agree with them. But as a scholar, I think it's not enough to condemn violence, but I want to understand it, which ultimately, I hope, can contribute to lessening violence even more.
Is the incidence of murder in a given historical time a good marker, a good indicator of general attitudes to violence within that society?
It surely is. Murder, of course, is the most extreme act of violence, but murder is an indicator for at least a larger reservoir of more serious violence. I don't think that murder is a good indicator for how many slaps people give to each other or how many times they quarrel or whatever, but it is a good indicator for the incidence of serious violence.
So when you began looking at murder statistics in Amsterdam historically, what patterns did you begin to see in the data?
I began building on the work of others, and there was a solid series of body inspections, dead bodies, they look for signs of a violent death. The first series started in the 1660s, and it turned out to have a rather low figure, low homicide figure, while it should have been a little bit higher. Actually, the 18th century had a higher figure for homicide rates. Fortunately for my theory, I found out then that there was a kind of ordinance saying that a lot of surgeons had inspected bodies unofficially, and that they were forbidden to do so. So I had reason to assume that there was some underreporting in the 1660s. So basically for Amsterdam, I found the same trend that others first in England had found of a long-term decline since the Middle Ages. But it's not always such a neat decline. You always have temporary ups and downs. And I really had to conclude that from about the 1690s through the 1720s, there was an upsurge in homicide in Amsterdam, which I cannot really explain, although I do know that there was a great fashion for knife fighting at the time, which I don't know why this fashion for knife fighting there was, but of course the homicide rate and the fashion for knife fighting were related.
And over a bigger period, do you see murder becoming more a matter of people who know each other killing each other rather than strangers? In other words, it's not the result of a brawl in a tavern. It's perhaps a husband killing a spouse, for example.
Yeah, usually we distinguish between strangers, acquaintances, and intimates as murder victims. And the share of intimates as murder victims has increased enormously from the Middle Ages until now. Again, I have to make a remark that since the overall murder rate has declined even more enormously, then the absolute number of intimate murder victims still was a little bit higher in the Middle Ages. But in terms of the proportion among all murder victims, the intimate victims are much more in the 19th and the 20th and now 21st century. The proportion of intimate murder victims is much higher than before.
We also see murder sort of being pushed to the margins of society in the sense that it may be more prevalent in the criminal underworld. I guess that's always been so. But as it retreats from other parts of society, or it, in enclosed pockets, communities that are not perhaps as integrated as the broad mass of Amsterdam society.
Yeah, that's true. Murder has become marginalized, more or less, as I say, in basically more in my previous book than in this one. But in any case, it used to be at least homicide, something that a murder that arose in a quarrel could be everywhere in the Middle Ages or even early 17th century. Many people would have had experience with at least bloody fights in their immediate surrounding. Well, now it's more a question of some neighborhoods, perhaps, or even deserted areas where people involved in crime take their dealings that can go wrong.
Now, tell me about notions of masculine honor, because that's an important idea in the book, which has implications for the nature and the level of violence in a society. So what kind of codes of masculine honor are you thinking of?
Well, it's a kind of traditional code of masculine honor. And I'm saying masculine honor because we also have female honor, but honor in every society is highly gendered. So male honor is always something quite different than female honor. But if we talk about male honor, in many societies, the traditional type of male honor obliges a man to fight, obliges a man to be brave, even to protect others, women or dependents, in a violent way. And that makes you honorable if you're able to really physically protect others or physically assert yourself when you are either attacked or injured, someone scolds at you or whatever, then you are considered an honorable man.
And if a code is operating like that, that suggests that the state doesn't hold and exercise a monopoly on violence. So it points to something about the way the state functions when a code of honor of that sort is highly visible.
Well, the state's monopoly of violence must basically be understood as monopolizing all military activities, monopolizing large-scale violence. It is, of course, never a complete or total monopoly, because that would mean that there are no murders at all, which obviously is not true anywhere. So the state's monopoly is a kind of relative monopoly.
But as we see states develop and become more sophisticated, we see this kind of masculine code of honor retreat, don't we?
We see it retreat, or what I call it, honor changes. And the basis of honor becomes different, and I call that the spiritualization of honor, because the basis of honor is like good behavior, or maybe even virtue, or being a good house father, or whatever. You see that in a nuclear form, so in the 70s and then coming through in the 80s and 19th centuries, that ever more men, usually first of those of higher social standing, that they can be honorable and peaceful at the same time. So that's in history, that's something relatively new. You are honorable and still have a peaceful lifestyle.
It's a sort of domestication, isn't it, of the male's notion of honor?
It is domestication of the male notion of honor. It is also literally a domestication first of the elites, of the aristocracies and patricians, who in the Middle Ages were even more violent than the rest of society. And there you see still the role of states as well, because increasingly the elites, they are tied to the center of the state, like in France, to the court, but also in other types of countries like the Netherlands. The elites, they change with the states, and then they propagate the peaceful man as a cultural model, which then in turn influences broader groups in society.
Now, the United States has a homicide rate many times higher than comparable Western nations. And you relate this to the way in which the American state was formed. Can you say a bit about that?
Well, my slogan for that is democracy came too early. And I should immediately add that this is a kind of rhetorical statement. It's not any judgment of value, but it's simply what has happened. Let me explain this, because it is perhaps a bit complicated argument, or really it's not complicated. It may sound complicated at first sight. In Europe, there was a much longer, states developed over a much longer period, over many centuries. And again, there were ups and downs in this process of state formation. Norbert Elias has analyzed it for France. And he said, well, the king, the French king, gradually could get a monopoly on military violence and on taxation in his hands. But there were constant counterforces. And these counterforces, the first few centuries, they were basically bent on destroying the monopoly. But at some point, there was a qualitative turn, as it were, that opposition to the king in France, or any opposition to the monopoly of force in other countries, turned not towards destruction of the monopoly, but tended toward co-possessing the monopoly, which in France happened in the French Revolution, which deprived the king of his monopoly temporarily, but in the end, the king disappeared, but the monopoly itself continued to exist and increasingly was sort of co-possessed by the representative of broader groups in society. That is what we call democratization. Now, that happened in Europe. In the territory which became the United States, development was much more rapid. The American Revolution came at a time when many people were not yet accustomed to being disarmed. They were not yet accustomed to having a monopoly of force that they would want to co-possess. They were still thinking somehow they wanted it both ways. Okay, it's good that we have a central government, but they still equated democracy with the right to self-defense and increasingly with the right to self-defense with arms in hand. So that's a powerful trait, has remained a powerful trait in American culture. Due to this, democracy came too early when people were still distrustful of a monopoly of force, and they have partially continued to be distrustful of this monopoly of force.
Yeah, the continuing to be distrustful is really interesting, isn't it? Because I find your argument convincing about its origins, but why do you think they still retain this adherence to the Second Amendment and reluctance to trust the state? Because on one hand, Americans strike me as much more patriotic than many Europeans, the sense of, you know, reverence for the flag and the nation. But still this distrust remains and this desire to hang on to their weapons.
Well, I think that still these origins also explain what happens next, that it is very difficult to establish the monopoly of force completely. There are powerful counter-tendencies which again have to do with the workings of American democracy, that even district attorneys are elected and all that. If a politician would say, well, I favor a stringent gun control, then he had a good chance of not being elected.
We've talked about violence, but punishment is another key part of the book. And I was fascinated by what you wrote about what you call the sacralization of execution. So an execution changes its dynamic and its effect and its meaning in history. So can you say what you mean by the sacralization of execution?
What I basically mean is that executions, they get a kind of religious flavoring. Actually, when I first started to think about it, and actually it's a development that in detail has been brought to light by other historians and myself, but I have theorized about it. So I first want to call it the Christianization of executions, but I don't think that that's a good concept, first of all, because there was a Christian world before this sacralization of executions, and secondly, because the sacralization of executions may have occurred outside Europe as well. As a matter of fact, I now know, after I published the book that it did not happen in China. Executions continue to be completely secular events there. But okay, in Europe, in the Middle Ages, there were few executions because there was much room for revenge and vendetta. Basically, a few perpetrators without really protective ties in their environment, or robbers from the countryside who were caught, those were hanged or executed in another way. And they were considered as completely worthless. And that made sense at the time in the whole judicial system you had. Then there was a kind of counter-tendency, first from the church, because people of the church said, everyone has the right of penitence. Everyone has the right to be absolved by a priest before he dies. So capital convicts too, which the authorities would not allow first because they think, no, these are people that are totally worthless. They gradually yielded, but that also came tuned in to the development of monopolies of force, of stronger states. It made sense, a more active system of justice. Then it made sense to make a whole show of executions. So, okay, they yielded to pressure from the church, but it also tuned into their changed interests. And then the message of executions became different. In a way, even painters depicted the crucifixion of Christ as, not of Christ himself, that was theologically impossible, but of the two thieves, as they are called, who were executed with them. You see, they modeled it after the contemporary punishment of breaking on the wheel. So there was an equation in culture between the crucifixion of Christ, which was also an execution, and thereby all capital convicts became a little bit like Christ. They were still despicable, dishonorable, but a little bit they became like Christ, and the message at executions then became, this guy or this woman has done grave crimes, deserves to be brought to death by the worldly justice, but even this man or woman can be accepted by God if he or she is penitent. That meant a very slight raise in the status of capital convicts, who were no longer completely worthless, but a bit like Christ. They had the status of penitent sinners.
And does that also mean that they're more like the people who are watching the execution? Therefore, the admonitory force of execution is stronger because they're not somebody completely separate from society. They're like you and me. And so it's more of a warning if they're a penitent sinner rather than some aberration.
Yeah, it surely enhances the sort of moral lesson that the execution was supposed to convey, because it said all people are potential criminals. Criminal may begin as a child who is disobedient to his parents. And so the message is to all children who were also taken to executions, obey your parents, otherwise you may end up there.
What does the presence in a society of a professional executioner indicate? I was interested in what you said about that in the book. Because I also didn't realize that earlier in the Middle Ages there weren't professional executioners. That was a later development.
Well, the presence of professional executioners means goes together with this sacralization and theatricalization, if that is a word, of executions. Makes it a core business of justice. Professional executioner signals the fact that vengeance is no longer allowed, that the state with its monopoly of force has expropriated private vengeance, and that it's now only done by the state.
I was also interested, Peter, in what you wrote about the instruments used for executions, whether that be the rope, the guillotine, the axe, the sword, and those having different significance.
Well, the significance of these instruments, again, has to do with honor. Punishment always brings dishonor in the eyes of contemporaries a few centuries ago. But the dishonor is relative, and especially the sword is the least dishonorable instrument used for punishment, which originally was reserved for aristocrats, elite people who they weren't executed too, there weren't executed too many of them, but if an aristocrat was executed, it would be done by the sword. But in the Netherlands, by the 17th century, the sword was in still the least desirable way of executing people, but that could also be done to just common people. And then it was considered an alleviation of their punishment to be executed more honorably or less dishonorably than when they were hanged.
And all these little alleviations, you call them, of punishment, are on this continuum from execution towards incarceration as the principal means of punishment, aren't they?
Well, that's the basic long-term trend. Of course, you have had incarceration and the scaffold together for a few centuries, but then by the 19th century, execution becomes much more infrequent, and the death penalty, when it continues to exist in most European countries until after the Second World War, but it is for 100 years, the last 100 years, it is executed indoors within prison walls. So incarceration really becomes the major tool of punishment from the 19th century onward.
You've mentioned Elias a number of times. The other important figure in this field, of course, is Michel Foucault. You had a very interesting essay in which you go back to Surveiller et Punir and actually look at what he said and find faults with it, which perhaps we've lost sight of because there's been such a vast secondary literature. But I thought that comparison of the approaches to punishment of Elias and Foucault was a very interesting passage in the book.
Yes, in fact, I have become more appreciative of Foucault than I used to be. I think I made a name in being Foucault's opponent. And then in the late 1990s, actually, I was invited in two places to lecture about my views of Foucault and contrasted with Elias. I hadn't looked at Surveiller et Punir for a long time, so I reread it and found, well, there are also good things in here. So I argue there are actually basically two things that Elias and Foucault have in common. First is that they turn to the past, to history, in order to explain the present. And the second is that they acknowledge that power is everywhere, the omnipresence of power.
But you find Foucault's identification of turning points or changes too rapid and not sufficiently considered, not seen in a big enough context.
Yes, having reconsidered Foucault, as I said, I see some similarities between Elias and Foucault, but there are also at least two major differences. One is that Foucault has an idea of a rapid succession of systems or structures or whatever you may want to call them, and he basically argues that there is a very quick transformation in punishment in 80 years, in the late 18th and early 19th century. I know from the empirical evidence that this is not true, that the empirical evidence supports Elias in viewing more long-term processes that are not linear, that go with ups and downs, but that take place over several centuries. That is one thing. And the second is that even though in their views of power, Foucault and Elias converge on one major point, that power is everywhere, that Elias has a much more, let's say, sociological concept of power, where power can be two-sided, where you also always have a balance of power, a power relationship, where even if the power, the relationship, the chances of power between group A and B are very unequal, that's still the group with much less power has, as the word less power already says, has still a little bit of power.
The way in which societies treat prisoners has become less harsh, clearly, over the last 100, 150 years. However, the number of people that we're locking up, whether that's in the Netherlands or the United States, and you show statistics for both, has been sharply upwards in the last four decades. So what do you think explains that?
I've been trying to look at what's the modern rise in punitiveness, which is clearly there, regarding especially incarceration rates. And as you say, that is in the United States and in my country, the same trend, how that fits into Elias's theory. There are actually two answers. One is an easy answer, saying, okay, yeah, you have a low point, you always have sort of ups and downs. You had a low point in punitiveness in the 1950s and 1960s, even early 70s, and that was when many people saw perpetrators as victims of a kind, victims of unfavorable social circumstances. So now we have a backlash at the 60s. I don't think it's just a backlash, but there's another thing, as I said, two factors. And the other thing is that modern punitiveness also goes together with a very much heightened concern for victims. And that is, if you want, a civilizing trend. It is much different than the concern with victims in the Middle Ages. That led to revenge and vendetta, and the concern was only there with the victim's relatives. But now we have in society at large many people who identify with victims that they don't know, but they watch crime programs about crime reporters and they identify with victims.
And at the same time, the rehabilitative function of prison seems to have retreated in financially hard-pressed Western democracies. It seems to be, well, certainly in my country, I get the sense it's more a storage problem, really, than a rehabilitation problem, seriously.
Yes, that's true. And it's difficult to say how this will develop in the future, but it's important to see that you have kind of a delicate balance between vindictiveness on the one hand and this civilized concern with victims on the other hand. And again, there are questions of capacity. I think that the decline of the rehabilitative ideal really has to do with the vindictiveness side of the coin. It remains a delicate balance, and we cannot predict how this will go on in the future.
You said earlier, though, that one of the functions of historical research is to try to explain the present. And I wondered to what extent you do try to take some of these trend lines on into the future and think, well, if this happens, then these will be the consequences.
Well, looking at historical evidence and studying the past can tell us something about the present in terms of which trends we see operative in the present. The lesson, if you want a lesson, historians usually say that history doesn't teach lessons, but the obvious way to act would be to try somehow to implement that the trends that you can identify in the present, that you try to reinforce the trends that you think positive and not to reinforce those that you think negative. But that would, of course, also be a matter for politicians.
But if I were to, in conclusion, to nudge you slightly to make explicit which trends you think are positive, what would you pick out?
Well, I would, for example, see both the concern with crime victims generally and the concern about violence. I would think that positive. And I would like... If I would be in power, I would like to reinforce these trends, but in a direction that would somehow exclude vindictiveness.
And bring rehabilitation back in a more serious way than it currently exists.
Yes, and bring rehabilitation back in whatever way we can.
I was talking to Peter Spierenburg about his new book, Violence and Punishment, Civilizing the Body Through Time, which is published this autumn. For more details, visit the Polity website at politybooks.com. That's all for this Polity podcast, but I hope to be back again soon with more interviews with Polity authors. I hope you'll join me then, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.